Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for coming to this Japan Chair Forum. My name is Nick Saicheney. I'm the Deputy Director and Fellow with the Japan Chair here at CSIS. And I'm delighted to briefly introduce our speaker today, Daniel Kleiman. He gave a talk here a couple years ago, soon after he published his book, Japan's Security Strategy in the Post-9/11 World. If you haven't gotten your hands on this, I highly recommend it. And when he spoke with us a few months ago and expressed interest in spending the summer in Washington, we were delighted, and we're very pleased that he's with us until the end of August, or at least for the next few weeks left as a visiting fellow. He's going to share some observations that he's developed and a theory that he's working on in his dissertation at Princeton University. And then we'll open it up for questions. So without further ado, Daniel, thanks very much.
Thank you, Nick. It's great to see so many of you here today. I'm very excited. This is the first time I've presented part of my dissertation before a Washington audience, so I'm really looking forward to your questions and comments after I give the talk. So my dissertation, the overarching question I ask is, how do leading democracies respond to rising power challenges? And why is this important? There's been a lot of work on the rise of China, on the implications of China's rise for Asia and the world. But there's been much less focus on how the U.S. and Japan, as leading democracies, are responding to China's emergence as a great power. And not as many questions asked, what is causing the U.S. and Japan to adopt certain strategies over others? And so that sort of general question is going to be the focus of my talk today. Now, there are many different strategies that a leading democracy could adopt when confronting a rising power challenge. So the question is, what's ideal? What is preferred? And I argue that really the optimal strategy for a leading democracy is binding. In binding, it's an academic term. It means essentially trying to bring in a rising power into international institutions. And why is binding, why is it preferred, why is it effective? International institutions, as the rising power enters them and becomes a member, there's a lock-in effect that breaking with the international institution imposes a cost. And so in the long term, international institutions, essentially, they constrain the rising power's behavior. So from the perspective of leading democracy, that's a good thing. At the same time, in the long run, membership in international institutions may reshape the rising power's interests and make them more akin to the leading democracies. There is essentially a socialization effect. Now, there's a third reason, and I think the most important, why this strategy of binding, of bringing in a rising power into international institutions, why the strategy is effective and desired. And that really is because, simply put, it's cheap. That it doesn't cost a lot, for example, to bring China into the World Trade Organization. These international institutions often exist before. Even if they have to be created, it doesn't cost that much to send diplomats to negotiate a treaty. By contrast, for example, a strategy that might involve increasing military budgets, it requires leaders of a democracy to impose a burden on the public. You have to raise taxes, for example, or perhaps conscript citizens. And simply from a domestic political perspective, no one in a democracy wants to ask for public sacrifice if they don't have to. And so binding, it's a cheap and potentially effective way of dealing with the rising power challenge. That said, there is an issue that if the leading democracy only binds a rising power and that's it, the leading democracy potentially leaves itself vulnerable in the future. What happens, for example, if the rising power turns out to have hostile intentions and the leading democracy has not developed military capabilities or strategic relationships with other countries that could act as a balance against the rising power? And so I argue, and I'll explain the logic behind this, that a leading democracy can only adopt binding if the rising power has an open regime, an open political system. And by this, I don't mean democracy per se. I mean the institutions that underlie democracy. And really, what an open political system means is, one, there are checks and balances, that authority is decentralized within the rising power. And what this means is that with multiple checks and balances, no single actor inside the rising power can take foreign policy decisions, run with them, and take them in a radical direction. And so if there are checks and balances, it makes the rising power more predictable and therefore safer for the leading democracy to only bind. Now, the other dimension of an open political system is transparency. that the governmental processes inside the rising power are observable, that other countries can look in, understand what kind of debates are going on inside the rising power's government, and adduce intentions. The rising power's intentions can be ascertained with a high degree of confidence. And in the end, transparency really boils down to a free press, that a free press can essentially extract information from a government in a rising power and then convey that to the leading democracy. So these two dimensions, transparency, decentralized authority, together they give the leading democracy what I call access. And by access, I mean the ability to actually intervene within the rising power's foreign policy process and actually shape decisions within the rising power. And why this occurs is because of the following, that if there are multiple domestic actors who all have a hand in foreign policy within the rising power, a leading democracy can identify sympathetic actors that can find domestic allies within the rising power and actually use them and work with them to head off outcomes which are not desired. And because the rising power is transparent, the leading democracy can identify who sympathetic actors might be within the rising power. So the question then is, what happens if a rising power does not have an open political system? In this case, power is centralized. Only a handful of individuals determine the rising power's foreign policy, and so there's a lot more potential variation in the rising power's behavior. There's a possibility of threatening surprises. At the same time, there's not a lot of information available because the rising power is not transparent. And so it's very hard for the leading democracy to decide what are the rising power's intentions in the future. Now, in this case, binding is still a preferred strategy, that you always want to try to constrain the rising power through institutions. But binding alone is insufficient, that if the leading democracy just binds, it's vulnerable in the future. And so what a leading democracy will do is supplement binding with hedging. And by hedging, I mean limited accommodation of the rising power while at the same time developing military capabilities and strategic relationships that in the future could be used against the rising power. And an example of this would be a case study I actually look at in my dissertation is Great Britain responding to the rise of Imperial Germany at the turn of the 20th century, where Germany was a monarchy, authority was centralized in the Kaiser, the German monarch. That Germany also did not have a free press, so Britain really was not sure what Germany's intentions were. And so Great Britain built up its navy against Germany while at the same time trying to bring Germany into international institutions. For example, a disarmament agreement on warships. So that would be a case of binding and hedging. Now, there's actually an unstated assumption, which I'll break out. Binding takes time, that bringing a country, a rising power, into an international institution, it doesn't happen overnight. And the kind of lock-in effects that institutions have also take time to actually work. And so thus far, I've assumed that there really is a low incidence of crises, that there aren't militarized disputes that the rising power is triggering. Because if the rising power does initiate militarized disputes, in the end, the leading democracy is going to conclude that there's a there's a potential for war in the short term. And if time horizons are short, then binding is no longer a feasible strategy. And so what is the other half of this 2x2 matrix that I'm gradually kind of showing you? Well, when there are a high incidence of crises, that the rising power is initiating militarized disputes, there are really two strategies that the leading democracy may adopt, and this, again, depends on the rising power's domestic institutions. If the rising power has an open political system, the leading democracy will actually appease. And those of you who followed U.S. elections know there's a lot of controversy. What does appeasement mean? I define it as unilateral concessions. There's no quid pro quo, just unilateral concessions that the leading democracy is making towards the rising power. And the reason why appeasement would actually be adopted in this case, there's multiple reasons. One, because the rising power is open, it's transparent, there's a lot of information about what the rising power's demands are and how it will respond if the leading democracy makes concessions. And so the leading democracy can concede with reasonable assurance that the rising power will not simply demand even more. At the same time, even if there are militarized disputes, the leading democracy still has access, that it can find sympathetic actors in the rising power and be assured that they will help head off sort of the worst-case outcomes. And there actually is a case of this. Some of you may still be skeptical. Would you really appease a country that if you think you might actually fight within a few years? And the answer is yes, that a case I've looked at as well is Great Britain and the United States at the turn of the 20th century. In Great Britain, actually at one point thinks there might be conflict with the United States. The United States basically threatens to fight Great Britain over Venezuela, that the British colony of Guyana is kind of encroaching on Venezuela, and the Cleveland administration basically threatens to go to war. And Great Britain concedes. It concedes everything that the U.S. demands. And the reason is because the U.S. Had a transparent system. It had multiple checks and balances that British elites could basically look. They could identify friendly actors within the U.S. polity. They could also realize that a lot of U.S. policy was basically driven by elections. It wasn't. There was no fundamental hostility on the part of the U.S. towards Great Britain. And so you have appeasement. And then the last example, what happens when you have a high incidence of crises, but the rising power has a closed political system? In that case, the leading democracy will opt for containment. And I think containment's pretty self-explanatory. The reason is, if there are these crises, there's no other information about the rising power's intentions except its behavior if it has a closed political system. So the leading democracy will look to its behavior, it sees various threatening actions, and concludes that, in the end, the rising power is irrevocably hostile, and it has to be contained. It has to be prevented from expanding. And a case of this would be the U.S. and the Soviet Union. In the late 1940s, the Soviet Union initiated crises over Berlin, over Iran, and U.S. policymakers ultimately concluded that the Soviet Union had interests which were really antithetical to the United States. So this is basically an overarching analytic framework for understanding how a leading democracy what might choose a strategy when confronting a rising power challenge. And now I want to move on and look at the title of this talk, which is, how did the U.S. determine what strategy to adopt towards Japan in the 80s and 90s when Japan was a rising power? So on the 2x2 matrix, which I just showed you, Japan would fit in the upper left-hand quadrant. That first, Japan had an open political system, that there were multiple checks and balances. Japan had a constitution, still has the same constitution, which basically delegates authority to different houses of parliament, and basically there are institutionalized checks and balances that are durable. At the same time, Japan was transparent. It had a free press, and this, again, was protected by constitutional safeguards. And then lastly, Japan, of course, was not initiating militarized disputes with the United States in the 80s or early 90s. So again, Japan would be in that upper left-hand quadrant, and given the analytic framework which I described, we would expect that Japan should bind, or the U.S. should bind Japan in the 80s and early 1990s. And that's indeed the strategy that the U.S. adopted. Now, I'm not going to go into great detail on the nuances of U.S. strategy during the Q&A. If people have questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Basically, overall, the U.S. had kind of three modes of binding Japan. One was bilateral economic agreements. There's a host of sort of an alphabet soup, the Moss Talks, the Structural Impediments Initiative, the Framework Agreement, and many others. And basically, all of these agreements were designed to essentially reshape the way Japan did business, and reshaped Japan's economy to try to alleviate areas of economic tension. And so it's sort of a classic form of binding to reshape, to constrain Japan and to ultimately reshape its economic interests. Another element of binding was consolidating the U.S.-Japan alliance, and that is, I think, pretty self-explanatory. And then the third was bringing in Japan into international institutions, basically trying to have Japan invest more, be a larger player in, for example, the World Bank, the IMF, and also have Japan take on a leadership role in the Uruguay round at that time. So again, the U.S. strategy was binding. Now, it's true that correlation is not causation. And so is this really the case, that the openness of the Japanese political system, was that really what influenced U.S. policymakers to bind Japan? And I would argue yes, and I would say there are three observations which lead me to conclude that, and hopefully will convince you as well. One was that because Japan had an open political system, its U.S. foreign policy elites really saw Japan as predictable, that they didn't expect foreign policy shocks. And the reason was because Japan was information rich. It had an open media, and I've talked with a number of foreign service officers who served at the embassy during this time period, and they've basically said that reporters were a great source of information. You could talk to reporters, you could look at the news, and one individual I spoke with said 60% of the information the embassy used was simply from reporters and newspapers alone. So clearly, having an open media helped, that the U.S. could use the information and determine what were Japan's intentions, what was going on inside the Japanese government. At the same time, the fact that Japan had multiple checks and balances, that there were many individuals in Japan who all had a hand in foreign policy, this also increased the amount of information available to the United States. regarding Japanese intentions. Because, for example, U.S. foreign policymakers from the ambassador on down could basically go to their counterparts, not just in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but in the Liberal Democratic Party, in a host of other economic agencies, and talk to them and get information. And think of the flip side, that if Japan had instead had a centralized political system, that if there were only a handful of individuals at this period who really influenced foreign policy, it would have been hard. Who would U.S. policymakers talk to? Only a few individuals. And it would be much harder in that case for them to have gotten information about Japanese intentions. And so, looking at this period, you don't find that U.S. policymakers really worried about policy shocks. There wasn't, for example, concern that Japan might either try to quickly develop a nuclear capability or break out of the U.S.-Japan alliance. That this wasn't expected because the U.S. had ample information about Japan and its foreign policy. At the same time, the openness of the Japanese political system meant that mistrust of Japan was contained. And to be sure, looking at the popular discourse during the 80s and early 1990s, there was a lot of mistrust. And many of you who lived through this, I think, can attest to it. There were books like Michael Crichton's Rising Sun. There was more academic work like Chalmers Johnson's book and Clyde Prestwitz and other authors basically saying Japan was an adversarial traitor. Japan was trying to turn the U.S. into an economic colony. Clearly, in the popular discourse, there was a good deal of mistrust. But it's interesting to look inside the U.S. government. What were U.S. foreign policy elites thinking? And that mistrust is not reflected nearly to the degree that it was in popular discourse. For example, in the Reagan and Bush senior administration, basically, mistrust was confined really to the Department of Commerce and often to sort of working levels, that even agencies that one might expect to see Japan as a real adversary, for example, the U.S. Trade Representative, USTR, basically they saw Japan as a closed economy, one that needed to be opened up, but they didn't see Japan as an enemy. For example, even Carla Hills, who was the U.S. Trade Representative under Bush Sr., she did not actually want to use the Super 301 legislation. It was basically legislation that threatened sanctions against Japan if it didn't open up its economy. She didn't want to even use that against Japan. She was forced to by Congress. And Japan had many allies within the United States government, that the Pentagon, the State Department, the National Security Council, during the Reagan and Bush senior administration, all of these saw Japan as an ally. They were not mistrustful of Japan and really pushed back against commerce and sort of groups outside the U.S. government who were mistrustful of Japan. Now, it's clear that the Clinton administration is somewhat of a break, that the Clinton administration did take a harder line on Japan for trade policy, yet I think it's hard to say that the Clinton administration really mistrusted Japan and saw it as an economic adversary. I think that would be wrong from the interviews I conducted, that really Japan was seen as an irresponsible stakeholder, but not an enemy, that Japan essentially it had outgrown. In the Clinton administration's view, Japan was a country that was not, it was a free rider. It had outgrown an export-driven growth strategy and needed to start sort of taking up its burden, its share of managing the global economy. And even looking at some of the rhetoric within the Clinton administration shows that although the economic side there were clearly tensions, the overall relationship, it was not one of profound mistrust. For example, the metaphor of a three-legged stool was often used by policymakers under the Clinton administration. And what this meant was one leg of the stool, the economic relationship, needed repair. But the other two legs, the security relationship, and U.S.-Japan cooperation on global transnational issues, these legs were seen in a healthy light, that they were seen to be strong. And so even in the Clinton administration, which one might expect to have harbored the most mistrust of Japan, even then, mistrust was contained. And then lastly, this idea of access. The U.S. was able to exercise access in a fairly profound way, and there are many examples of this, between 1985 and really 1995, during kind of the height of the Japan Challenge. And I'm just going to cover one, which is the Structural Impediments Initiative. And this was basically an initiative that the Bush senior administration undertook to promote structural reforms in the Japanese economy. And throughout this initiative, the U.S. really was able to leverage the fact that Japan had multiple actors who all had policymaking authority and that Japan was transparent. For example, when framing this initiative, the Bush administration worked to co-opt Japanese reformers, that the embassy in Tokyo actually identified individuals and agencies in the Japanese government who had basically reform ideas similar to what the U.S. wanted from Japan, that embassy officials went through all the documents that had been written by Japanese agencies, by Japanese scholars, and basically picked out recommendations and then made those U.S. demands. At the same time, the U.S. was able to identify and exploit internal divisions within the Japanese government because Japan had multiple checks and balances and was a transparent political system. For example, U.S. policymakers basically worked with the Liberal Democratic Party against the Ministry of Finance, that U.S. wanted Japan to consume more and save less. And the LDP liked consumption because it meant more pork for their constituents. And so you would see U.S. policymakers go to LDP politicians and basically get them to pressure the Ministry of Finance, who didn't want more spending. And then lastly, and I think maybe the most impressive example of access, is that the U.S. was able to directly appeal to the Japanese public because the public in an open political system had a voice. And that actually Japanese, basically when U.S. policymakers would go to Tokyo, they would couch U.S. demands as really benefiting Japanese consumers, that reforms the U.S. wanted Japan to make would make products cheaper in Japan, they would increase public service for the Japanese consumer as well. And there's some funny anecdotes about how effective the media campaign was. For example, there was one cartoon, basically a salaryman and his wife talking over dinner, and his wife is complaining that prices are much too high. And he says, oh, don't worry, the Structural Impediments Initiative, that'll fix it. And then he says, and then she says, honey, and you know, our apartment, it's really small. Don't worry, the Structural Impediments Initiative, that'll handle it. And so it worked, that the public sort of sided with the U.S. in this case, put pressure on the LDP, which in turn pressured the bureaucracy and basically broke through obstacles, and the U.S. was able to actually make real headway in this. So access, it did work, because Japan had an open political system. So that's the Japan-U.S. case. What does this all mean? Let's take this back to the present now. What does this all mean for how the U.S. And also Japan are trying to manage the rise of China? Are there really any implications, or is Japan and the U.S. is a kind of an anomaly? I would argue not, that looking at the Japan-U.S. case, and also the broader analytic framework, which I gave earlier, I think there are real lessons. One of the main differences, of course, between Japan and China is that China, it has a closed political system, that it has centralized authority. There aren't legal checks and balances in the Chinese regime. And China is not transparent. There's not a free press. And so what does this mean? Well, one, it means that China is really in that lower left-hand quadrant of the 2x2 matrix I showed you earlier, which means that the U.S. and Japan are currently hedging and binding against China. And that really, it's the proper strategy, that because Chinese intentions are fundamentally unclear, because there's not sufficient information, that simply to bind would leave the U.S. and Japan vulnerable in the long term. And so hedging is advised. At the same time, one of the lessons of the kind of overall analytic framework is that mistrust of China by the U.S. and Japan is really inevitable, that even in the case of Japan, which had an open political system, there was some mistrust at the popular level. But in the case of China, mistrust is really rooted in the nature of its domestic institutions, that because there's not ample information about what is actually occurring in the Chinese government, because there's not a free press. And so there are always going to be concerns, and I tried to allude to this in the pictures I gave, about Chinese long-term intentions. That is China, is the glittering skyline of Shanghai kind of depicts, is China going to be a great economic power and a pillar of the international order, or ultimately will China seek to change that order to its own interest, to overturn that order potentially? And because China is not transparent, there's a lot of uncertainty about what path will China ultimately go down. And this creates mistrust, which means that although efforts, for example, to develop close relations between U.S. and Chinese leaders or Japanese and Chinese leaders, these efforts are certainly to be commended. They're certainly useful. But at the end, they are not going to alleviate mistrust because mistrust is rooted in the nature of Chinese domestic institutions. And then what kind of recommendations for U.S. and Japanese policy flow from the analytic framework which I've discussed? Well, one of them is to promote the rule of law in China, because checks and balances, it creates greater predictability within a rising power, that the rising power is less likely to surprise other countries in threatening ways. And of course, promoting checks and balances and rule of law in China is not an easy thing to do. Clearly, the Communist Party wouldn't want to create many checks and balances. But even, for example, empowering judges in China, or even within the Communist Party, trying to encourage efforts within the party to develop more rule-based interactions, even that might create more checks and balances and promote greater predictability in China's policy. Then also, looking at transparency, the Pentagon pretty much every year hammers China on its lack of transparency on the military budget side. But simply, one of the things China has responded by is by producing white papers, which, again, is an important step. But at the end, I think the analytic framework I've discussed, it shows that it's not enough, that ultimately the information in a white paper is something which a government chooses to disclose. And really, real transparency in China or any other closed political system, it requires freedom of the press. So what does this all mean for China? Well, there are some positive lessons, I think, for China. One of them is that although clearly it's in the U.S. and Japan's interest for China to become more open, to have a more open political system. But it's also in China's interest as well. That China, one of the stated goals of their foreign policy is to reassure its neighbors in other countries, the U.S. included, about China's rise, to reassure other countries that China will use its power responsibly. And becoming more open will do just that, that it will actually boost China's international position, that other countries will be reassured. They will hedge against China, I think, they will hedge less strongly against China if it becomes more open. And basically, China will face a more benign international environment if it does adopt more sort of checks and balances and become more transparent, have a freer press. At the same time, the corollary is that other efforts by China to reassure countries about its rise may only amount to cheap talk, that it's not terribly, it won't be convincing. For example, the white paper on defense, which I mentioned, and then other efforts, for example, the rhetoric on peaceful rise, which I think the Chinese government ultimately realized it was almost counterproductive, because rhetoric alone, it's information which a government is disclosing. It's not the same as having information that's actually extracted by a press from a government, which other countries see with more credibility. And then likely, and I think this is definitely a positive lesson for China, looking at the kind of analytic framework which I described, containment of China at present is very unlikely. That containment, it's costly for democracies. It often involves raising taxes to pay for higher military budgets. Nobody wants to do that in democracy. Nobody wants to contain China if they don't have to. And so China doesn't really have to worry about containment, certainly if China avoids initiating militarized disputes, which it seems like they learned after the 95 and 96 missile crisis over the Taiwan Strait. As long as they stay away from those kind of disputes, nobody's going to try to contain them. So I think in that sense, this should prove reassuring to China. And then finally, to conclude, what are the general implications for U.S. foreign policy? One of them is that fostering democracy still remains a core U.S. national interest. And obviously, democracy promotion has kind of gotten a bad name in the last 8 years. But in the end, fostering democracy is still important, and not for necessarily ideological ends, but because the institutions that really underpin democracy, they make countries safer for the United States and Japan and other countries. That democracies, because they have checks and balances internally, they are more predictable. Because democracy entails a free press, their democracies are more transparent to outside countries. And they are more likely, because there are multiple actors who are sympathetic potentially to outsiders, that democracies are more responsive to the interests of the United States, Japan, and others. And so democracy, fostering democracy, remains important. And then lastly, and I think this is important as well, that really fostering democracy, it entails a focus on institutions, not elections per se. That really it's these institutions, the role of law, the creation of checks and balances, the creation of a free press. These are the institutions that really make democracy safe for their neighbors and for other countries. It's not necessarily elections. So on that note, I think I've probably gone late already. I want to say thank you, and I look forward to your comments and feedback in the next hour or so.
Great. Thank you very much, Daniel. I'll use my prerogative as the moderator to throw out three questions based on each of the three areas in your presentation. You can answer them or choose to ignore them. That's entirely up to you. And then we'll open it up for questions and group discussion. First question, briefly, the matrix you laid out obviously depends on the degree to which foreign policy elites assess the likelihood of crises. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on the definition of a crisis that you're using to develop this theory, because that could have implications on the types of decisions and strategies that are employed. Secondly, with regard to China, in your research, have you been able to identify specific factors that might lead decision makers to shift between hedging and binding? Your explanation of the binding and hedging component was very clear, but it seems to me that it's not always 50-50 and that there's a shift, and I was wondering if you could amplify the degree to which policymakers have to deal with that issue. And finally, on the general implications, since you brought up the election earlier, I'll just throw this out at you. In terms of fostering and democracy and institutions specifically, I'd be interested in your comments on this notion of a concert or a league of democracies, and how you think that might fit into the theory that you're developing.
Great. Well, I will try to answer all three briefly, since I want to take others from the audience as well. In terms of what is the definition of a crisis, basically, I didn't give you it there. I didn't want to get into a lot of technical detail. A crisis, as I define it, is at least the rising power threatens to use force against leading democracy, or it exhibits a display of force, or it actually uses force. So that would be kind of the definition of crises. And so potentially, for example, the 1995-96 Taiwan Missile Crisis, that might amount to a threat of force or a display of force directed against the United States. In terms of the factors that lead decision makers to choose between hedging and binding, to me it seems, because they're not really alternatives, that basically you always see binding. For hedging, partly hedging involves domestic costs, that hedging, building up the military, costs money, and so there may be somewhat of a domestic component, that if there are other domestic demands on policymakers, they may hedge a bit less and focus more on binding. If they face less harsh budget constraints, they will focus more effort on hedging. And it also depends on the rising power's behavior, that if the rising power is behaving provocatively, but let's say short of threatening to use force, you'll see more emphasis on hedging. And a good example of that would be, let's say, Imperial Germany and Great Britain, that even before Imperial Germany starts threatening to use force in various crises, which start in 1911, it's behaving pretty provocatively. It's building up its navy very rapidly. And so you see Great Britain basically start putting more and more emphasis on hedging because Germany is behaving in a kind of provocative fashion, even though it falls short of really kind of a crisis. And then how the League of Democracies or the Concert of Democracies, how that fits into this idea. I think it's a good idea. It doesn't speak directly to the kind of analytic framework I described, in that I don't think having a League of Democracies or a Concert of Democracies, it's probably not going to encourage a country like China to, in order to enter one of these organizations, to sort of create more checks and balances or to have a free media. That I don't think that'll make a difference on that account.
Well, let's open it up for questions. If you just identify yourself and your affiliation. Yeah.
Steve Cerullo with the Virtue. The likelihood is that China's neighbors are going to be in the position of neither being able to bind nor contain. They're probably going to buffer. And I'm just wondering how that sort of would fit into your rubric, into the matrix that you drew out. Is it going to kind of sit on a line? Is it a question of degree more than it is kind?
That's a good question. Basically, to clarify, what I described right now is really looking at how leading democracies, basically democratic great powers, respond to a rising power challenge. And I think you're right on. As smaller countries on China's periphery, they do have fewer choices. But I think democratic great powers like Japan or the United States basically confront kind of a strategic choice like the matrix I described. Smaller countries, I think, do have the choice. They have the choice of hedging, at least. I think binding, clearly it's not easy for a small country to bring in China into an international institution, but smaller countries can certainly hedge by developing relations with the United States, for example, for tightening security alignments. Thank you. I mean, I think India might actually... I think they would fall into that camp. In the future, they may actually have more leverage. But I think, for example, India, by developing closer ties with the United States and increasingly Japan, they basically are hedging against China's rise. I think that is pretty much indisputable.
When you spoke of the incidence of crises, particularly in our conflict, you framed it as being instigated by the rising power. Wouldn't it be the same case whether it's instigated by the mature democracy? I mean, it's still going to produce the same outcome. I didn't understand the distinction there, that it's the rising power instigated the conflict and crisis.
Well, clearly, we all like to think that democracies don't initiate militarized disputes. Of course, they occasionally do, though I think empirically much less. Basically, why I argue that it really is the rising power initiating militarized disputes is, one, statistically, that leading democracies, they do initiate these disputes with much greater rarity. And the reason The main reason is that if a rising power is the one to initiate the dispute, basically that affects perceptions of the rising power, especially if the rising power is a closed political system. For example, as I mentioned in the case of the Soviet Union, that really by initiating a militarized dispute, a rising power is signaling something about its intentions. Whereas if leading democracy is the one who initiates the dispute, there's really no new information about the rising power's intentions that it can gain. And at least in the cases I've looked at, I've really never actually seen a leading democracy be the one to initiate these disputes. That's a great question. I will first give the standard academic non-answer, which is it's beyond the scope of my theory, since I'm looking at how leading democracies respond to rising powers, not quasi-autocracies or whatever we want to call Russia now. That said, I mean, to me, it does seem like Russia is, in a sense, trying to hedge its bets, that clearly they have good relations with China, but they also are trying to have at least some potential sort of exit options by keeping the door open to the U.S., by keeping the door open to Europe. I mean, to me, it seems like they are, if not hedging in the sense that a leading democracy might be, that they are clearly trying to prevent themselves from becoming too dependent on China. As far as China sort of responding to Russia's rise or simultaneous decline, to me, it seems like basically the main Chinese strategy is diversifying their energy resources, that they don't want to be kind of like the Europeans who are depending on Russia. And so China tries to go into sort of the developing world and find other oil resources there, so the Russians can essentially monopolize their oil imports.
Ben, welcome to the State Department. As part of the U.S. government, I sort of look with envy upon your chart of four separate things, because in my mind, you know, what little area that I look at, we seem to be doing all four boxes at the same time. We're appeasing in certain areas, we're binding in certain areas, we're hedging in certain areas, and we're containing in certain areas. So, I guess, I mean, I can't speak to the direct content of the various charts you drew up, but I wonder if there's a way you can incorporate the fact that, especially in leading democracy, where by definition, as you say, there are different actors in different power centers, you can sort of incorporate the fact that different parts of the leading democracy may be doing all those things at the same time.
I think it's a fair point. Obviously, when you're trying to sort of explain a very large phenomenon like a strategy, you have to make some abstractions. I do think, though, if you try to be precise about how you define strategies, for example, appeasement, I think it would be hard to say overall that the U.S. is giving unilateral concessions to China on most issues or on pretty much any issue, that you're going to find, even if it's not on that issue, the U.S. is getting sort of a reciprocal concession on something else. And so I think to say that the U.S. is really appeasing China on even pretty much any issue is probably not the case. There's usually some kind of back and forth. At the same time, for containment, I think we have to be very careful how we define containment. The fact that the U.S. has an alliance with Japan, alliance with Korea, developing some sort of strategic relationship with India, I don't think it's hard to call that containment. These relationships are not being kind of actively directed at China, certainly not in the sense that the U.S. used its relationships with Europe and other countries against the USSR. And I think one thing I didn't mention during the presentation, but containment to me also really implies an almost economic warfare, that ultimately a rising power sort of is buoyed by its growing economy. And so containment really means trying to essentially harm the rising power's economy. And I think nobody could argue that the U.S., in a sense, the U.S. has probably contributed more than any other country to China's economic growth. And so it's very hard to say, I think, that the U.S. is in any real sense containing China.
How would you apply your theory to the South China Sea, for instance, I was interested in that because from very, quite early, China has staked out a claim to a large sort of mass of water, which it's never really surrendered that claim, which overlaps the claims of other countries in the region. And I just wondered how you would expect the U.S. or Japan to deal with that kind of situation, particularly if oil or natural gas seems to be potentially available.
That's a great question. I think that gets back to the point of the lack of essentially transparency in that sort of how to take a claim like that, that there's not a lot of information. What is China really value this? Is it something they really want to sort of ultimately achieve in terms of control over that area? Or is it something which just for nationalistic purposes, they put it on their maps? And the fact is, because there's not a lot of information about what really Chinese foreign policy elites are thinking about the South China Sea, I think you do see a lot of mistrust and concern about what does that mean when you see on a map that this is all part of China, according to their maps. And so I think kind of to get to the point that really this contributes to hedging, that, for example, something, it's certainly not a crisis, it's arguably could be called in kind of an aggressive move or something that is provocative, and because there's not a lot of context why China is making these claims, it tends to fuel kind of worst-case scenarios, I think, certainly in the U.S. and in Japan and in other countries.
Thank you for your presentation. Listening to your presentation, I feel like it's very much in line with what we all know about security dilemma or a threat perception. And I think he is giving a reference in sense of the kind of regime of the power, the rising power has in terms of international domestic condition. For example, you mentioned about the transparency and the check and balance system, which is domestic infrastructure. So to me, it seems very much similar to threat perception or security dilemma. How would you actually differentiate more clearly how your theory differs from what we
theory know as people? That's a great question. Just to clarify, the security dilemma, it's an academic concept that basically it's difficult for countries to differentiate often between sort of offensive and defensive capabilities. And so even though countries may be building up for defensive purposes, to their neighbors it looks offensive. And so you basically have kind of the spiral of tension where countries build up, even though neither has hostile intentions. And it's unstable, and ultimately war may ensue. I mean, I basically would say this, it's similar to the security dilemma. Basically, I'm sort of embedding domestic institutions in the security dilemma, to put it kind of very simply, that one way to get out of the security dilemma is to have domestic institutions that have checks and balances, to have transparency, to have freedom of the press, that basically the security dilemma is created because there's not enough information. And so these domestic institutions are one way of providing information and through checks and balances, providing reassurance against surprise. Great question, though.
You made a good comparison between China and Japan in the 1980s and early 1990s, but I think the Japanese case was, Japanese rising power was basically economic rising power, but in China case, I think both economic and military rising power. So if the open regime and the transparency of Japanese case helped America contain Japan, do you think if China become more transparent and open their regime, do you think it will still help them? Because it's not only the economic part, but I think it's more complicated in the Japanese case as a threat to America.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, why Japan is sort of an economic challenge, China is more of a full-spectrum challenge, economic and military. I mean, I think with the case of Japan, though, you can still argue, even at the time, Japan was not a military power. But, I mean, conceivably, there could have been much more intense fears that Japan would translate its economic capabilities into military power, that Japan might have developed nuclear capabilities as well, that there would have been some sort of strategic breakout. And I think it's a fair point, but I think you still could have seen those kind of fears, and the fact that they didn't really exist in a significant form is telling that the kind of open political system Japan had sort of alleviated whatever mistrust on those grounds that might have emerged. I think the case of China, clearly developing military capabilities, there's always going to be some mistrust involved. But I think if China did become more open, there would be, certainly this is the rhetoric that comes out of the Pentagon, that basically if there was an understanding of what were the motivations behind China's military capabilities, I think that would allay fears fairly significantly, that I think most kind of reasonable observers would not deny China the right to modernize its military is a great power. But the fact that it's unclear what are the intentions behind that military modernization, I think that's what creates most mistrust.
I have two questions. First, I'd like to ask about the definition of transparency. Now, the Japanese government is trying to strengthen information security ability and counterintelligence ability. If the Japanese government succeeded, do you think it will decline lower the level of transparency? This is the first question. And the second question is my Russian diplomat friend told me that the US government is trying to spread the democracy all over the world because of their interest. So if they realize such US intention, don't you think it is very difficult for US to spread democracy?
Thank you. Those are both great questions. In terms of sort of the security laws that Japan might institute, my understanding is that they would not limit freedom of the press in any significant degree. And ultimately, from the kind of the cases I've done, really having a kind of vibrant and unfettered media, that is the guarantee of transparency. And sort of around the margins, some laws to protect confidential information would not be sufficient to sort of impinge on the freedom of the press. In terms of how can the U.S. spread democracy if other countries think that, you know, this is in the U.S. interest, partly, I mean, I would hope that, for example, my argument that openness actually has benefits for, let's say, China as well, that other countries will hedge less strongly against it, there's that, that openness in spreading democracy, or at least the institutions underpinning democracy, may also be in other countries' interests. Even in the case of China, for example, rule of law, dealing with their environmental problem, that one of the main issues for them is that without rule of law, it's very hard for the central government to kind of crack down on local officials who are not actually enforcing environmental laws. And so even there are many benefits, I think, to spreading rule of law in China. So you can argue that the institutions, it may be in the interest of other countries. Of course, it gets to the point, how can the U.S. spread these institutions? And I think clearly, especially after the last 8 years, it's not easy for the United States just to sort of tell countries to adopt these institutions. But I think it really is a matter of capacity building that, for example, trying to help China strengthen its judiciary or to have Chinese reporters interact more with Western reporters and basically trying to actually build up capacity within other countries and help actors who ultimately probably would push for more transparency, for more rule of law. And I think that is probably the most durable way to create institutions as well.
Your model creates a fairly compelling case for the institution that you're talking about, for the democratic press and law, and your previous answer as well. But I'm curious to what extent you think there's any value to those institutions outside their instrumental role. You know, some of us from different areas within the discipline might call them norms. And I wonder if you would accept that characterization in addition to considering them as institutions,
Absolutely. I mean, I think hopefully all of us in this room would agree that democracy, from a normative perspective, is definitely important. But kind of for the purposes of my analytic framework and the arguments, I chose basically to focus on kind of the informational part, just because this would get much too complex if I started talking about norms. And also, at least in academia, a lot of people, including myself, we feel like norms they're kind of squishy. They're very hard to measure and talk about. So I didn't include that. But that, yeah, I completely agree. The normative part's important.
To quote Henry Kissinger, China is China. And have you ever thought, could it be that the challenge isn't just, you know, one necessarily of scope, you know, both military, political, I guess, and economic, but all three, but it's of scale? and this is the first time, this is the largest chunk of the human population that is entering what we might call the mainstream. And if you have any concern that they almost can't fit into these categories in some way, that just the sheer size and the shock of the international system would reshuffle the deck in some way. I mean, does that make any sense?
I mean, I've definitely heard arguments like that before. Not to plug one of my professors, but there's actually a great article that came out in Foreign Affairs a few months ago by John Eikenberry, basically looking at that question of China. It's a huge country compared to any other rising power and population, order of magnitude difference. But at the same time, what is the international order? It's not just the United States in terms of the kind of group of countries who subscribe to democratic norms. It's not just the U.S. It's Europe. It's Japan, Korea, India, other democracies throughout the world. And so when you kind of make that comparison, if it's just a kind of U.S. versus China, ultimately China might have a larger economy. But if you look at sort of China and the sort of democratic countries in the current international order, China is big, but it's not as big as I think you would indicate. So I don't think it's a fundamental problem.
Thank you, Dan. I've been thinking about what you pointed out for lessons for China. One is rules of law, and the other is freedom of press. And I've been thinking about rules of law may be accomplished in China someday. But I'd like to ask you know, how are you going to introduce freedom of press into other country? You know, rules of law, in case of China, I think if we induce China, why don't you obey international rules we share in WTO or intellectual property, then you're going to lose the economic opportunity. Or a couple of other rules we may maybe ask China to follow. But economic rules or economic interest may be a power for the certain country to catch up with international rules for we share in democracy, almost all countries all over the world. But freedom of press, I mean, this, I think for the particularly in case of China, it's very important and may be very tough. As many people said, China has a fifth of the population or even increasing in the future, and they they are not really informed, the Chinese people, because there is lack of free press. And if we think about the future of this planet, this accurate information or accurate knowledge or balanced knowledge is very important to everything, from economy to military. And China's people, as a fifth of the population of this planet, doesn't really given the correct information, is really, I think it's really a threat. If if the China country or China moves to a little different direction, but I've been thinking about really very hard to how to get the other country, other people know or get to have the freedom of press. So, well, I don't really ask the answer directly from you, but on the way for you to think about the lessons for China or lessons for as a rising countries, rising nations, what would be the key for freedom of press?
I mean, it's a tough question. I think it's a long, slow process that clearly I don't think anybody expects freedom of the press to just kind of magically occur in China overnight. But I think slowly building capacity, for example, as I said, trying to bring Chinese reporters, have greater interaction with Western reporters, sort of expose them to best media practices throughout the world. I think most media people don't like being censored, and that there will be ultimately pushback by, let's say, younger Chinese reporters who have experience in the West and realize that their counterparts don't have to sort of check things with the government. And that, yeah, I mean, who knows? It could be decades-long process. But I also think, I mean, and it's always dangerous to give personal anecdotes, but I mean, when you talk to Chinese who know that they're censored, they don't like it either. And I think most people ultimately they do want sort of free and accurate information. And so I do think there is or and will be sort of a pull within China to have a more transparent and free media. I also think in some ways, although, I mean, it's a two-edged sword, but even for the Chinese government and the Communist Party, there are certain advantages of a more free press, for example, rooting out corruption or trying to sort of identify environmental problems, that the press can kind of act as a warning of abuses going on at the local level. So there are, it's a obviously double-edged sword, but there are some advantages for them. But I agree, it's not an easy or a quick process.
When you talk about concert of powers, or democracies rather, I could have thinking about NATO, which is engaged in Afghanistan, but not in Iraq. And it's there was an era when NATO included non-democratic countries like Portugal or Turkey. But today, all the new East European countries that are coming into NATO are democracies. I do not think they would be considered for membership in either NATO or the EU if they were not. And my question is, what is the role of that kind of an alliance in a situation like today, where, I mean, you know, countries like France or Germany could pick and choose. They chose not to get involved in Iraq, they did get involved in Afghanistan. And what are the implications of the eastward extension of NATO today?
Well, this will be a dangerous stray away from my area of expertise and the kind of analytic framework which I just described. But, I mean, I think the organizations, in a sense, they serve as one tool in a sort of varied toolkit which the United States has, and hopefully, in many cases, the U.S. can work with its democratic allies in NATO and other places to try to fix global problems like in Afghanistan, and in other cases it may not work, but I don't think that they have lost their relevance. Certainly, I mean, it's been a very useful, the combination of NATO and the EU has been a great tool for ensuring democracy in Eastern Europe. So I think they still are important, those kind of organizations.
It's kind of slightly related to the question from Wolfson. I think he was talking about the economic freedom with certain rules of law on the activities. And freedom of press means probably political freedom, meaning pure democracy. The way that I was at least told in the 1990s is that as the economy grows, middle class grows, and then middle class people want to exercise political freedom. That's the way country becomes democratized. That hasn't happened in China. And we don't see happening anytime soon. So I guess the question is, do you see that happening in China in the next 10, 15 years? Or if not, then how do we talk to Chinese government, which is not democracy, but needs some kind of focus from China over kind of agendas like climate change, energy consumption, things like that? How do you see that?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the jury is still out on whether kind of economic growth will ultimately make China democratic. I mean, there's a whole kind of academic literature which they compel you to learn in graduate school. And basically the gist of it is we aren't sure whether economic growth leads to democracy, whether economic growth prevents democracies from relapsing into dictatorship. And so it's not really clear. I mean, I think you're right in that currently there are not a lot of signs that economic growth is really boosting sort of calls for democracy in China, that the government, the Communist Party, has been quite adept at basically co-opting elements of the middle class, entrepreneurs, businessmen, into kind of the governing apparatus. And so, I mean, I think the jury is still out. I think we can all be hopeful that change will happen, but it's certainly, it's unclear. In terms of how sort of we deal with a China that is not democratic in the future, I mean, I think basically a mix of cooperation and competition, which you pretty much already see now, that on issues where interests align, that the U.S. and other countries can cooperate and do so very well with China, and on issues where they are at loggerheads, there will be tension.
Sure.
You mentioned the certain level of mistrust is going to be a given with the Chinese relationship. What steps do you think are appropriate for the government to actively manage that level of mistrust? I'm thinking of a reactive case, you know, that incident where the American spy planes were landed in Hainan, and that was resolved very relatively quietly behind the scenes without raising the level of mistrust there. We contrast that with the incident where the U.S. accidentally bombed the Chinese embassy, and that resulted in, you know, Chinese government busing in protesters to attack the ambassador presidents. Where the government does have the ability to some degree to manage the amount of public mistrust, where do you think are appropriate responses, particularly in Japan, where you've got a segment of the population that are nationalists who have an interest in or an inclination to raise the public mistrust for Japan?
That's a good question. I think we do have to differentiate between sort of public mistrust and mistrust within the kind of governing elites, and that was basically what I was discussing. But looking at the kind of public mistrust, I mean, my impression in Japan is that kind of the nationalist group, which you alluded to, it's a pretty small segment of the population. And so, I mean, I think basically trying to come to some sort of mutual understanding with the Chinese, which, I mean, Fukuda has been doing on various issues of tension, not sort of ratcheting up tensions over Yasukuni, but at the same time ensuring that the Chinese don't take provocative actions either. And in terms of public mistrust of China on the part of Japan, my sense there is that the ball is kind of in China's court, that a lot of mistrust of China in Japan at the popular level is often very just reactive, that, for example, during athletic games, if the Chinese crowds basically behave poorly towards the Japanese teams, that creates mistrust among the Japanese public. And so it seems much more reactive to me.
I think Japan is not a major issue at all, or even not a minor issue at all. But actually, from the beginning of the 80s or something, most of the Japanese believe that we have not been a problem at all against the U.S. or something. So even now, most Japanese believe we didn't problem at all against the U.S. or something. So we believe, on the other hand, we have not changed at all from the 80s or 90s or something. But on the other hand, actually, some people in Washington, even now, say that Japan have not changed at all in the very different context or something. So actually, I want to know what happened in the 80s or 90s between U.S. and Japan under your explanation or something.
Sure. I mean, the difference really is basically starting from the mid-1980s until about 1995, a pretty broad swath of U.S. foreign policy elites saw Japan as an economic challenge, namely that Japan was potentially might eclipse the United States in certain high technology sectors, if not become a larger economy in aggregate relative to the United States. So that, by rising power challenge, that is why I think the decade from 1985 to 1995 is very different. That at that point, U.S. foreign policy elites really did think that Japan, the future industries of tomorrow, might really be all Japanese. The U.S. might lose out. It might not be internationally competitive. And I don't think you see that. You certainly don't see that after 95.
Sure. The back.
Oh, okay. Somebody earlier was talking about nationalism. And I want to ask you a question regarding nationalism. In the recent years, there has been cases in which the Chinese government used nationalism a protective mechanism. For example, like the Tibetan riots, while the international free press were framing it as, you know, China was cracking down Tibet, the protesters inside China, the media is framing it as the Tibetan rioters attacking Han Chinese. And I want to see if you think that increasing open media that's going to China. And if you think the Chinese government is going to be increasingly rely on that happening in the future, as more information becomes increasingly open up.
That's a great question. My impression was it was a backlash against not necessarily open media within China, but it basically against open Western media that was publicizing and giving China bad press. I mean, I think you raise a good point, which is why promoting freedom of the press in China, I think, will be a very kind of long-term and difficult endeavor, in that the Chinese government is able to right now use the press to kind of boost nationalism when it needs to for legitimacy. And so, in a sense, I think you raise a very good point, which is as the press becomes less sort of government-controlled, the Chinese government will start having to yield some of that ability to kind of boost nationalism up when it needs to for its legitimacy. So that's a good point.
Well, there's one thing that Japan does share with China, and that is that neither of them are Western countries to begin with. But Japan has the rule of law. Japan is very similar in many ways to the leading European countries, although not necessarily to the United States. And it also seems to me that we think of China as communist China, but the content of Chinese communism has really changed over the past 20 years, particularly since the last 10 years, and I suppose it's partly the regime, but it's also the entering of such huge numbers of people into the middle class, and we don't have an educated population of the magnitude that you have in China today. So we can't predict from what we have seen heretofore what China is going to become, nor even can we really have a static view of the content of Chinese communism, because we tend to think of its origins, we tend to think of its of Mao, but who knows in which direction it's going to continue to evolve, even while there are constraints on that the ideology itself imposes. And this is simply a plea for a more unconstrained view, or a willingness to think somewhat more regionally about China today. Because when you use the word communism, you tend to think of the past, and certainly not of the future.
That's a fair point. I mean, at this point, the Communist Party, they still call themselves communists, so I'm kind of at a loss of what else I should call them, even though I agree. I mean, they're not pretty much all the sort of Maoist era theories, and I mean, that's all been jettisoned. But basically, just to clarify, when I use Communist Party, I mean the ruling party of China, whatever kind of philosophies they want to subscribe to. It's basically, I think anybody would say, it's a kind of a dictatorship, a normal authoritarian dictatorship, that it's not sort of the traditional communism of certainly the Mao era. It is gone. But that doesn't mean that there still are, basically there's a unfree press and a lack of checks and balances, that has not changed.
You're saying it's going to be a long-term sort of waiting sort of thing, I guess, for China to become more checks and balances, open free press. But right now, I feel like Beijing wouldn't want things like that globally. As you're saying, it's really unstable. So I was wondering what you envision in terms of what the United States can do to promote democratization in the long term, other than just waiting for Beijing to change, just whether the U.S. is there.
That's a good question. I mean, I think we do have to differentiate between elections, and that's what I was trying to get to in the final slide as well, that I think clearly elections in China would be destabilizing. I think most Chinese might not even want them at this point. I think most Americans who study China would tell you that basically, if you could sort of wave a magic wand and China was suddenly democratic, had free and fair elections, you would probably see a much more nationalistic foreign policy than we do today. Because, in a sense, the Communist Party, the government of China, basically it exploits nationalism, but it also keeps a lid on it. So I agree. I think elections, it's not something the U.S. at this point should be pushing for, and it would be destabilizing. And clearly, the government of China would not accept that. I do think, though, that certainly rule of law within China, I think there are benefits for the Chinese government for the way their system would operate. So I think that is something that might have some appeal within the government already. In terms of transparency in a free press, again, that it's not, I don't think it's something the U.S. or other countries can basically sort of tell China, do this or we'll, whatever, punish you or exclude you from some sort of international organization. I think it really comes from the bottom up, in that I think the U.S. and other countries can try to hasten that process by basically working with elements within China, reporters, judges, other professionals who might actually be the ones to sort of start pushing for this internally. But I don't think there's much more that can be done.
Someone mentioned in their question previously about the scale of China. And the scale of the Chinese military, despite the publishing of white papers, the lack of transparency in their military development, kind of maybe gives people the impression that China is in a category of being a high incidence of crisis, perhaps, because of its scale of the military and the lack of transparency. I was wondering for your matrix, if containment, because of the nature of the Chinese government being more of a closed government in your matrix, even if it were to cross over to the threshold of becoming a high incidence of crisis, what's the feasibility of containment being a strategy? I kind of feel like even if there was a high incidence of crisis with the rising power of China, that containment would still be a strategy that would necessarily be the option that government or policymakers would choose. I was wondering if you had any response to that.
Sure. I mean, I don't think that as China builds up its military, people may see that as provocative because there's a lack of information. That is not, though, the same thing as sort of having militarized crises. And I think, I agree, I think it'd be hard for the U.S. and Japan to suddenly shift to containment. It's not a strategy anyone wants, something a lot of U.S. allies at this point would not be happy with either. I think, though, the kind of, let's say, militarized crises that might lead the U.S. or Japan to flip from binding and hedging to containment would almost be game-changing. For example, if there was a conflict in the Taiwan Strait that it was clear China initiated, it was not Taiwan's fault. I think something of that nature, that would be a militarized dispute, potentially a war between the U.S. and China if it escalated. But I think something of that nature, really kind of a game-changing event, you would actually see a shift. And I think you would actually see U.S. allies in the region, assuming it was not Taiwan which had provoked the incident. You would see even U.S. allies probably begin to favor more of a containment strategy. But short of an event like that, it does seem unlikely to me.
A couple more, and then we'll...
The question is that even without the effort of the Chinese democracy, such as what they pursued as binding or hedging, I feel that a closed regime, the rising power themselves, will feel pressure to join the international mechanism anyway. For example, China will eventually feel pressure to join international organizations, as you have mentioned. And I hear it also said that somehow the democracy complex will be formed. So what is your response to that? What is your assumption behind saying that the democracy will always have a strategy to face this rising powers? Because sometimes rising powers themselves can actually just be automatically pressured to join international organizations like China.
Well, but I mean, you actually even mentioned at the end that they have to be pressured. And sometimes, I agree, China certainly gets benefits from being in the WTO, and there are certain incentives to join organizations. But overall, I think it's still a good strategy for a leading democracy to adopt. And you actually see a lot of historical cases where rising powers that have closed political systems actually don't want to be bound. That, for example, the case of Great Britain and Imperial Germany, that Great Britain really wants to have these like naval disarmament agreements with Germany. And basically the British, are, for their part, they're binding. They're trying to negotiate these treaties, and time again, the Germans just kind of shrug it off, and they negotiate, and they hit a deadlock. And so I think you raise a good point, that because institutions can be made attractive enough that you're not going to have, it doesn't take a lot of effort for the U.S. to try to get China into certain institutions because they're attractive. But it's not sort of a de facto that the rising power will just want to enter institutions, certainly not all. Good question, though.
If there are no other questions, we'll wrap it up. Please join me in thanking Daniel for an excellent presentation.